Once you've had a glimpse, there's no way to turn back. No way. Big South. Big Zuko. Forever. Almanac. Cock a doodle doo to you chickens and roosters out there for another fresh, delicious, succulent slice of Zuko pie. The flavor? Big Zuko's Forever Almanac, a chronicle of reminiscences. The pie maker? Myself, Daniel Kurland. The sous chef? I didn't use a sous chef. Why would you think that I used a sous chef? Is the Zuko pie too good than what you think I'm capable of? That I need assistance to hit pies of this echelon? Well, fuck you, man. Fuck you. I tried. I really did. And just forget this. Never mind. Sorry about that. I've been a little stressed lately. They just canceled Towers for Algernon, that 9/11-based anthology show, and I am not taking it well. But this is all bigger than that. We can move on. The funny thing is, not too long ago, I was actually in the highest of spirits. I, quite surprisingly, received a very generous grant from the Podcasting Foundation of America for continued work in The Irregular. I was fairly resolved on spending this money towards research regarding Jenna Stade, who more astute listeners will remember from past episodes, an evil presence and decimating spirit that defeated Jackhost and the Gotta Be Warriors, but also seemed quite set on making Big Zuko as dead as the devastating, terrible victims from the 9/11 still have Towers for Algernon on the brain. But I was going to spend this money trying to track down Jenna Stade, as it's been some time since he's made contact, and in doing so, maybe get closer to Zuko himself. I was about to begin my long process into this hunt when the night before I suffered a terrible nightmare. In this nightmare, I was completely naked, walking down the side of the road in the middle of the night. It looked like I had been doing this for a while. There were no cars. There was nothing at all. Until eventually, at long last, a vehicle approached me. But inside of it was no driver, only jackals, their many glowing eyes staring back at me through the windows, and when I turned to run to get away, I saw that outside on the road, I too was surrounded by jackals. And then they all slowly began to move in on me, closer and closer and closer and closer, and then I woke up. I woke up feeling cold, with the faint scent of sulfur in the air, and not a single thought about Jenna Stade crossed my mind again that day. Instead, what I was interested in investing this grant money in was a project that I had long been thinking about and was always in the back of my mind to some degree. The important thing was, now that I had the money and resources to approach this goal, I shouldn't abandon it and run away. I should be dedicated and see this through. I should see through a project that was so radical and controversial that it was often suppressed or hushed away into submission. This project was alphabetical time-telling. Now, let me say something up front. I think there is nothing wrong with numerical time-telling, the current popular method of time-telling. The world has just changed and progressed so much that you'd think there would be alternatives, at least. Options. And so, that's all that this is. An option. A fun new way to tell time! And let's be honest, numbers can be confusing. This follows the simple replacement formula of 1 being A, 2 being B, 3 being C, and so on. Since the alphabet has 26 letters and there are 24 hours to a day, this is almost very clean math. Since letters Q and X seldomly are used, they're eliminated from the alphabet, making it a workable 24-letter system, in spite of how cool it would be to be able to say X o'clock. As you can imagine, this system is pretty straightforward. 2 p.m. would become 0 o'clock, 8:30 a.m. becomes H30, 4:15 p.m. is obviously quarter after R. The money from this grant would go into the research, prototypes of clocks and watches, field studies figuring out if people can accept time-telling with letters, and general manpower to guarantee that all of this is a success. And it happened. I pulled it off, and all still $300 under budget in the end. The final step was meeting with Alexei Yurgenev and Dalton Speckle, the president of clocks and the surgeon general of time, respectively, to have them approve of my proposal. It was one thing to crack the math and physics behind alphabetical time-telling, but without their approval, it would mean nothing. I'd be no different than the schmuck that tried to propose color-based time-telling. And unfortunately, Mr. Yurgenev and Speckle didn't view me any differently. Pretty much from word one, they shut down my idea, saying that something like this would never come into practice. The numbers are precise, and that there's a respect to numbers that I wasn't paying and have no business to be mucking around with time. I tried to explain to them that I did respect all of these things, and that a good deal of time and money had been put into this idea, but they didn't care. I was dragged out of their office before it was even 1:30 J. I still think there's something to be said for what I did, though. I resurrected an old idea that I had passion for and didn't want to see be given an unfair stake. And after all of this, rather than feeling bitter about the time, or should I rather say letters, wasted, and the slander slung at me, but instead, my brain kept combing over one of the more tantalizing tales out of Big Zuko's Forever Almanac. A tale that saw him taking dedication to a dangerous level too, titled, Black Hole Sun, Won't You Come? And wash away the weight gain. Fame was a heavy cocktail, ladies and gentlemen. One not meant for the lightweight. It had a strong, acidic aftertaste, and it'd go right to your head, and was often loaded with bitters. But, as of late, fame was my drink of choice. And I was getting doubles. And the ice cubes were made out of arrogance, or something. The reason behind the stature metamorphosis was because of my Ghosts of the Adventuestrian series, a spin-off of my Adventuestrians franchise that was witnessing tremendous success. Who'd have thought that children would be more interested in stories about people turning into horses than adults would be? I had just come out with book 34, They Shoot Adventuestrians, Don't They? Releasing them at the rate of a book a month at this point, and the public's interest didn't seem to be waning. Oh no, it was waxing, if anything. Waxing. And I also was enjoying a time in my life where I seemed to be consistently doing book readings and cable talk show appearances. Monday had me on Morning Glory with Pam and Lori. Tuesday saw me as the middle guest on Hidden the Snooze with Becky Apnea. And Thursday I was on both Eggs and Bakey and Eggs and Bakey. The former being a breakfast cooking show, the latter being a marijuana-based morning show. From the few times I managed to catch myself on television chilling my soul, I thought I looked bigger, bloated even, in the public eye. A feeling that my svelte self had never particularly felt before. But with the binge writing I had been doing lately, lost in a frenzy as finger hit key, causing hoof to hit cobblestone in the fabled world of the Adventuestrians, I had also been binge eating. The time for fine cuisine and meal preparation fallen to the wayside, and I could stand to lose a few pounds. I did try to course-correct my body, rather than assuming this problem would just solve itself. I sought out the majority of diets out there, trying out every fad and system, all with middling results that got me no closer to satisfaction. Yo-yo diets, as they say. Take a penny, leave a penny diets. Two steps forward, one step back, and then another step back diets. And just as I was about to accept my fate as someone that would constantly bark out that the cameras add 10 pounds line, and figuring out what's the most flattering angle to pose for my book jacket, that I overheard something potentially life-changing coming from the capybara wrangler on the set of Joe John and the Brunch Bunch. And no, I'm not talking about his recipe for Kit Kat Skittles and cream cookies, which almost felt like cruel baiting considering my diet situation, but the other piece of information I overheard him going on about was something called the sun-gazing diet. The principles behind this absolutely legitimate, 100% real sun-gazing diet, which was explained to me as the man's ropey capybara fed on Logan berries from his hand, are based on the idea that the sun is a source of nourishment and enrichment that is there to be absorbed. The diet requires a commitment, but has incredible payoffs, and asks you to stare at the sun an hour before sundown, when it's at its most ocularly attainable, for increasing amounts of time each day, building up a resistance. After a month of doing this, you will never have to eat solid foods again for the rest of your life. Did you hear that? This diet claims that after doing something as mundane as that for 30 days, you then won't ever need to put solid foods into your body for the hundreds of thousands of days you have left in this life. that the sun creates a feeling of fullness and stability and enrichment that staves off the need to get fuel from elsewhere. You're feeding from the sun's power. And this wasn't insane. I went online, found countless articles, testimonials praising the diet, that this clearly wasn't just some capybara wrangler fever dream. So why not give it a shot? And even if it works and I don't need to eat solid foods ever again, that still doesn't mean that I can't enjoy them from enjoyment's sake every so often. And so I began the start of my sun gazing, feeling no need to tone down the opulence, sitting as close to the middle of Central Park as possible and staring right up into that powerful star. The same star that Galileo and Edison and Nixon looked up at years before, not for dieting purposes, but looked at all the same, letting its beauty beat down on me as I went over meditations in my head and tried to clear everything else around me as I focused on that ball of fire. I sank into the ground and let the magic do its thing. And 60 minutes dragged by, and I felt exactly the same the next day. And the day after that. And for the rest of the week, I didn't feel any different at all. And even worse, I felt like I was eating more now than I ever was before, out of fear or insecurity, or perhaps my body even had some weird deficiency where increased amounts of vitamin D led to increased appetite. I even varied up my locations as to where I was looking at the sun, calculating what park would have me positioned at peak distance and altitude. And I kept at it. Each day, my eyes dilating a little further, my skin getting a little more exposure to sun, my body being atrophied and stasis for a little while longer with each passing day. At this point, due to the lack of difference I felt in myself, I started overcompensating. I began staying out longer each day than what was required of me, some days getting so lost in the trance of my meditation that by the time I came to, it'd be the middle of the night. But my skin would still linger with a warmth and glow to it. Every day, skirting the edges a little more, cheating the guidelines as a means to jumpstart my diet and trick my body into accepting this absurdity. In the final week of my sun gazing, I was still bitter that I wasn't feeling anything, in spite of my prolonged sun exposure and severe commitment to the regiment. But as I saw myself passing the mirror that day, I barely recognized the skinnier stranger staring back. Having been so caught up in the routine and trance of sun gazing, I didn't even notice that its effects had been working. I just needed to be patient. And I was optimistic that my final week with the program would seem to end in a success after all. Well, success is relative, isn't it? So I suppose I did succeed here, but the me that thought upon this certainly didn't look or feel like a success. But rather, a gnarled near-skeleton full of angles and crannies. A near-skeleton that could have all the cameras in the world pointed at him and he still wouldn't look halfway to normal. I should have followed the rules. I should have read the guidelines more carefully. None of the testimonials online spoke of the participants turning into Billy Hackett from Thinner. No, just like many other things in life, I had gone too far. I let out a groan, which had become a regular addition to my routine now, as I felt my organs seizing up, contracting and eating themselves. This is how thorough I had been. This is how good a job I dieted, that literally internal organs were trying to slim down to bikini size, get rid of the pesky cellulite on that liver and the cankles on that small intestine. Naturally, my first instinct was to try and cram as much morsels of food into my body as possible, trying to bulk up this mass before my skeleton crumbled under the weight of my skin. But the diet was right. I couldn't eat solids anymore. And as I tried to replenish my body continually rejected everything I put into it. Not just on a molecular level, but food didn't even taste good to me anymore. Chocolate took the guise of bloody copper. The idyllic mix of tomato sauce with melted mozzarella cheese tasted like ash mixed with bleach when it hit my palate. Every fresh piece of fruit was rancid sludge. And as I looked up from the toilet bowl, vomiting my hope down into the water pipes, I experienced the very real thought that maybe this diet was simply past the point of reversing now. Hours later, I groggily woke up, still perched over the toilet, but noticing a series of hives and rashes over my arms. Furthermore, I was itching. Badly, and it wasn't until I was twisting and turning my bony body over the bathroom floor, trying to satiate my scratching, when a beam of sunlight from the window hit me, and everything was briefly okay. For a second, the nanobites that had taken residency in every follicle of my skin had shut down. It was the sun. Apparently, another effect of me going drastically overboard with the sun-gazing diet saw my body physically requiring sun exposure every day, or I saw myself getting incredibly weak and breaking out in abrasions. My life soon became an acceptance of this as I tried to bring my weight back by overdoing it on liquids, something my body could still stand to stomach, and adopting a sedentary lifestyle to avoid any unintentional weight loss through pesky hidden exercises such as walking or standing. You'd be surprised how many calories the human body burns up moving an arm, bending a knee, furrowing a brow. But now I was efficiently collecting these calories, not letting a single one go to waste, as I fenced them into my body with the hopes of rebuilding mass. As you likely imagine, the whirlwind of the press tour that I was very much enjoying prior to all of this had taken a sharp hiatus. I had tried to make certain dates and appearances, but simply didn't have the strength, let alone the passable appearance, to keep up my obligations. However, a certain book reading had drawn near, and it held such a weight to it that I knew canceling was not an option. I was doing a read at an anorexia center, being there to help tortured children that were experiencing very real problems. This reading was happening because one of the Adventuestrians, Delilah, a frequent love interest between Kensington and Knox, leading to the acclaimed A Horse with 12 Legs and 3 Hearts story arc, has anorexia. And what was initially started as a touching piece of synergy now had me worried that my appearance would directly offend them and appear like I was mocking their condition. But I didn't want to let down the children. So I dragged myself up, putting on clothes that long ago stopped fitting me due to sun gazing, and felt myself resorting to filling them with things like stuffing and straw, so I appeared somewhat regular, me becoming this twisted take on a scarecrow that's not trying to scare anything at all. Not a scarecrow, but a welcome man. Yes, just trying to look like a welcome man as I went out into the world to read stories about horsemen to the anorexic children. I didn't get far into things before I threw up everywhere. No, only about 3 pages into Delilah's battle with the Equest Screeans, those of course being a mysterious enemy to the Adventuestrians that are half horse and half bat, hence the Scree in the name, only 3 pages in before the complimentary welcome cookie that was forced onto me by the group leader upset the now incredibly fragile balance of my stomach, myself managing to make eye contact with all the confused children as my watery red eyes looked up from the waterfall of toxins that ran beneath them. As I grabbed at my face, clumps of straw and stuffing gradually fell from my sleeves, my body deflating and becoming an anorexic before and after picture right in front of their very eyes. They'd never hear about how Delilah would defeat those Equestrians. I found myself leaving the office of Lawrence Lawrence, again in my welcome man costume, the Mark II version of it, trying to explain to him that for the time being, all of my press would need to be done over the phone or in print until I knew what to do here. But on my way out, my sunken eye spotted a chinchilla wrangler seated, waiting to see my agent. There was a book in her lap with a picture of chinchillas on the jacket that seemed to indicate she had written the thing and was looking for representation. This stood out to me, having just seen a capybara wrangler in the not-too-distant past, but I continued on my move, eager to escape the judging, curious eyes that combed over me. I continued until I heard the trainer say the words, "moon-gazing diet," into her phone. At that point, I locked the door to the waiting room, hung up her phone, and told her to tell me everything she knew before my pancreas swallowed itself. Loretta de Maurier, the chinchilla wrangler, became aware of the moon-gazing diet as a means of plumpening up her chinchillas. In fact, it's more of an anti-diet. Her chinchilla played and chewed with the straw coming out of my pant legs as she continues to tell me that this diet employs the same principles as the sun-gazing diet, but naturally, with the moon instead. In this permutation, rather than not eating solids, the slow reintroduction of solids into your diet causes your body to release enzymes and chemicals stored inside of you that increase weight gain and fatten you. Suddenly, there is hope again in my life. There was a large ball in the sky up there that would heal me and set things right, and all I had to do was wait for the other ball up there, the one that was husking me out, go to sleep. And so, for the next 30 days, my life very much became the inverse of what it was before, the negative of its former self, hoping that I could eventually turn this life back into a positive. The moon-gazing diet saw me flipping my clock upside down so I could be up at night, watching the moon. Every night saw me returning to some park, staring upwards, as skinny as a demon, looking like a vampire, meditating for my normalcy. Moongazing saw that my plans routinely got cancelled, that my work didn't get done anymore, as my life turned into this bizarre regimen that I was worshipping to the point that you'd think that it wasn't a rodent trainer that turned me onto all of this. Each night, as I stared at the moon in silence, the only sound being the dry, dry sucking that my organs now regularly did, either shrinking smaller, or perhaps finally growing stronger, I had no idea anymore. Emaciation is healthiness is obesity. I saw weirder degenerates with each passing night, creepier individuals with each new moon phase, sand-eaters and tree-climbers making eyes at the glow children with their pseudo-sanctuarians. Them probably looking at me and thinking I'm the weirdest of the lot, that the dragon man who prays to his moon god every night is the most dangerous one of them all, they whisper, I'm sure. As I approached the final week of my moon-gazing anti-diet, I began to wonder if my brain was possibly losing weight from my previous endeavor too, that perhaps my brain had been eating itself all along and that the only thing being accomplished here was a few extra lines of nonsense in my inevitable obituary. But I was almost there. Regardless as to whether this healed me or hurt me, I was almost there. The nights these days were their fiercest yet, as if the sun had personally paid the denizens of the post-meridian to be out at their most dangerous until I gave up and surrendered. One night, as I gazed up at the full moon above me, I saw a gangbanger stab a trio of skateboarders in my peripheral vision, trying to distract me, trying to break my focus, trying to get me to look away, and as soon as I did, I would be next. The next day, a baby carriage was stolen in my peripheral. Then, a rape. But you can't fool me, son. It's not going to work. And before you know it, your pull over me will be over, and I'll be able to eat a sandwich again. But on the final night, there were no crimes, or distractions, or breaches of humanity. It was just me and the moon. Until Loretta de Maurier appeared, chinchilla in tow, and our duet became a foursome. We never acknowledged each other, nor did I break my vision with the moon as she approached me, but I knew what she said was meant only for me. Loretta preached about how the sun was evil. She preached about how Lucifer actually means enlightened one, or enlightener, illuminator, and that in the past I had been absorbing Satan into my body, that is why I had gotten so weak, because Satan had taken all my strength. But now, I was finally healed. Now I was finally free of the Illuminator. Some clouds passed across the full moon, obscuring my vision of it. I took the micro-opportunity to flash my eyes towards Loretta, but nobody was there. It was just the moon and I. When I woke up the next day, I ate when I wanted. I drank when I was thirsty. I devoured what I felt like, but showed restraint all the same. This is what eating is. This is what eating should feel like. Not a Rube Goldberg machine of organs and restrictions contorting you into something uncomfortable, or using the sun or the moon to transform you into your ideal self. My phone rang. It was Lawrence. I was excited to talk to him about getting back on the saddle, pun intended, with these adventuestrian tales, but my stomach rumbled, and so I went to the fridge to explore my options. The call could wait. I was hungry. Okay, that was a weird one, wasn't it? Very different. But just like I was saying before, dedication can be a wonderful and inspiring force, but be careful not to direct it into the wrong areas. That being committed can be just as dangerous as being negligent at times, and next thing you know, you could have a big piece of storage space filled with alphabet clocks if you're not careful. I'm glad Zuko could solve his problems, though, and I hope that there are not others out there afflicted by the dangerous sun-gazing and moon-gazing diets. I'm off, continuing to do more research in Genestate. Whether it's funded through a grant or not, I'll get to the bottom of it. But that's all for this time. It's nearly half past F after all, and I need to get ready for this interview I have at 8 o'clock. I've been Daniel Kurland with Big Zuko's Forever Almanac, A Chronicle of Reminiscences. And until next time, the Chronicle is chronic closed.
Once you've had a glimpse, there's no way to turn back. No way. Big self. Big Zuko. Forever. Almanac. Forever. Almanac.